I'm Brandon Sedloff, the host of the Distribution Podcast. I've been humbled by your support. Every day, I get emails, text messages, LinkedIn messages from listeners around the world. I started this podcast a little over a year and a half ago as a way to codify and share interesting conversations that I'm having with industry leaders across private markets. I figured I'm very fortunate that I get to have these conversations, and every time I learn so much, so I might as well hit record, create a platform so that I can share the learnings with all of you. None of this would be possible without the support of Juniper Square. For the last 10 years, Juniper Square has been powering the investment operations of private markets across real estate, private equity, venture capital, crypto, and more. And Juniper Square's earned the trust of more than 2,000 investment managers around the world that we support with a global team of nearly 600 across our fund administration and technology businesses. If you have a fund that you're thinking about launching, have a fund administrator that you work with that's not meeting your needs, or maybe you just want to learn more about what it would look like to outsource some of these functions for the very first time, but you also want to ensure that you're maximizing the efficiency of your business and you're creating a leading world-class experience for your investors, then drop me a line, brandon_thedistribution@junipersquare.com, and I'll personally make sure a member of our team gets in touch. Thank you for listening and for your support of this podcast, and enjoy the episode. Welcome back to The Distribution by Juniper Square. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff, and today I'm sitting down with Greg Friedman, CEO of Peachtree Group, a private equity firm that manages over $2.5 billion of investor capital. On this episode, we discuss the hospitality real estate markets with a focus on select service hotels, the massive opportunity for private credit, and the health of the U.S. consumer. I could have discussed each of these topics with Greg for hours, and I know you're going to love this episode. Let's get into it. Greg, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Brandon, for having me on the show. I'm looking forward to spending time together today.
Let's start with how you got started in real estate.
Yeah. So myself personally, I grew up in a family that owned some commercial real estate. They owned a lot of, hotel properties. They owned a business that actually did a lot of lending to hotel owners. So personally grew up around the business, both on the credit or debt side, as well as the equity side across hotels, as well as, my family owned a lot of other just commercial real estate property types. And that started really with my grandfather, and my mom worked for my grandfather. And then, I worked every summer for the, family business growing up. So I was cheap labor. And then went to school at University of Texas at Austin. And when I graduated Texas, I went into banking, where I specialized in capitalizing and financing primarily hotel projects, back when I was on the banking side. So finance capitalized over 300 hotel projects before starting Peachtree in 2007. So that was really from a, personal perspective around the business. And then professionally, obviously, spent time in and around the commercial real estate space, focused primarily on hotels before starting Peachtree.
So it sounds like real estate's in your blood. Was it, as you were a kid growing up? By the way, where did you grow up?
Yes, so I grew up right outside of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. It was a very small town. And my family, had my grandfather actually originally had moved to this town. So I grew up, this town called Fayette, Alabama, which is about 50 minutes from Tuscaloosa. And so it was a great place to live, but it was a great place to start out just because my family owned a lot of the real estate in that town and, around, the state of Alabama as well too.
So growing up in, near Tuscaloosa, I mean, was it obvious to you that the thing that you were going to do as an adult was get into the real estate business? Or how did you balance this family history with real estate and your own kind of personal career ambitions?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So originally, my grandfather was, he was a doctor by trade. He was an eye doctor. And so he didn't want me to go into real estate, really didn't want me to go into business in general. His belief, because he grew up, back during the Great Depression. And so he was a big believer in getting a master's in something and thought I should be a doctor. And so he was very passionate that that he thought I should go become a doctor. And then once you become a medical doctor, then you can become entrepreneurial and start businesses and get into real estate. And so originally I was focused when I went to college, to University of Texas, I was focused on being a doctor. So I was a biology major of all things. And so it was a little bit, I came through. So although I grew up around the business, I never really thought I was going to end up being in a situation where I owned hotel properties or owned a business that helped capitalize and finance commercial real estate assets, as well as, you know, focusing on buying and developing hotels and so forth. So it's sort of interesting that I ended up here, and it's almost by accident that I did end up here. But it's worked out really well.
So you studied biology. At what point did you make the transition from, you know, the medical doctor path that your grandfather wanted you to be on to, you know, whether it's banking or real estate? Was that something that you knew kind of after you enrolled in biology, it wasn't right for you, or you had a different plan, or did that happen kind of more by happenstance later?
Yeah. So it happened really, so junior year of college, I think I started coming to the realization, because at the time, you know, at this point in time, I was, you know, 20 years old and I was working because I had a job in addition to going to school at University of Texas at Austin. And I just realized I really was getting burned out going down the track of, you know, biology and medicine. And it just wasn't what I wanted the rest of my life to be. My grandfather wasn't totally sold that that was the smartest decision. And he's been a huge, you know, influence in my life. He was, you know, very much, you know, I had a lot of respect for him. And he was somebody that I really, you know, modeled myself after. So, you know, out of respect for him, I wanted to try to become a doctor, but also I started realizing that wasn't my true passion. And so, you know, as junior year sort of unfolded, you know, I started looking at the possibility, if I did, you know, ended up not going to medical school, you know, was there a path to go down the road of business? And at the time, I did have, you know, one thing, you know, I left out, is although I was working, I also had a couple of different, I call them side hustles, you know, different businesses that I was, you know, running myself, and thought, you know, one of those businesses could be the path to, you know, being able just to not, you know, end up going to medical school. And so as I transitioned into my senior year, you know, it became very evident that if I was going to not go down the medical school route, I was going to have to find a full-time job. And that's when I started, you know, looking at different opportunities. And this goes back to, you know, 1999. And, you know, back in 1999, if you lived in Austin, Texas, and you were, you know, a student at University of Texas at Austin, you know, the big opportunities were, you know, going to work for like Arthur Andersen in Houston, which fortunately I didn't go down that path because we know how that ended. You know, Enron was another one as well. And so, you know, fortunately I didn't go down either of those paths, nor did I have the, you know, background or experience or even the education to get, you know, opportunities with them. So I was, you know, looking at different opportunities, and, you know, fortunately I had a, you know, relationship with somebody that was running one of the divisions at General Motors at the time that did hospitality finance. And I was able to get with, you know, get an opportunity to go interview there, and ended up getting my first job out of school, you know, at GMAC Commercial Mortgage within their hotel finance group. And that was my first, you know, entree from a professional perspective into commercial real estate.
Out of curiosity, what were the side hustles?
Yeah, so it was a couple of different things. One is, you know, I had a business that actually we sold pagers. So we actually, myself and I had a partner at the time, and we went out and we bought a bunch of pagers. We bought paging lines from, you know, PageNet back again. This is back in like 1997 and 1998, back when pagers still existed. So, which is sort of interesting, because I talk to my children about it today and they don't even know what a pager is, but it was, you know, something that was part of our life back in the 90s and so forth. But, you know, I had a business that did that. I had a business that was focused on the internet at the time, which the internet was relatively, you know, new back in 1997, and had created a company that was a portal to the web for college students. And it was something that was focused primarily at the time, was focused, you know, at University of Texas and some other schools, and had some success with that business. And thought, you know, it was something we could scale up. Unfortunately, myself and my partners ended up deciding, you know, after several years of having that business, we ended up, you know, going different directions, but we did make a little bit of money off it. So they were, you know, each of these side hustles, you know, were successful in their own right, but they weren't going to be, you know, successful enough to get me to the next place I wanted to be.
That journey during college brought you to GMAC, and you're doing hospitality finance. But before we get into kind of the pure real estate background and Peachtree, I'm curious, you know, you grew up in a real estate family. You know, what were some of the experiences? Like, what did you think about real estate as a kid? Was it just something that you were always around? You know, you mentioned you were cheap labor. Are there any jobs that you were doing during the summer that kind of stand out to you now as a hotel, you know, owner and kind of hospitality real estate professional?
Yeah. So it's funny, like every summer, like I spent so much time like stuffing envelopes for, you know, basically sending out, my family owned a business that did a lot of lending. So they would send out the monthly invoices and I would have to stuff the envelopes with the invoices and help put the stamps on them. So I did a lot of things like that as a child. I used to travel with my mom. She would go to different hotel properties that we owned. She would go to different hotel properties that we were looking to finance. We owned, laundromats back in Alabama as well, too. So I used to go to those to collect the actual, money, the quarters and so forth out of the machines. So it was a lot of, I would say the lessons I learned is just, it's hard to say it's lessons. It probably just helped build that discipline and knowing that you have to constantly be involved in the business. You got to constantly make sure you stick to a schedule, be proactive to take care of stuff before issues arise. You have to, deal with, managing individuals and managing teams, being able to understand and sort of see that. Because, as a child, I wasn't necessarily doing all that or setting it, but I was watching, if it was my grandfather or my mom, being able to observe and watch them as they were running, their business. It was a really good education for me. And it allowed to, really set that foundation. And so I think it gave me that initial discipline to take the next steps in my career, both, from an academic perspective. When I was in college, I did very well from an educational perspective, even though I shifted. But also since graduating college, I've always, lived a very disciplined life and a very disciplined schedule. I'm a big believer in that. And that's what helps promote success.
Fascinating. So after GMAC Finance, is that when you started Peachtree or was there something in between?
Yeah, so started Peachtree, so GMAC got a little bit complicated in the sense our group at GMAC, was there from 1999 till 2005. I was part of that group. And unfortunately, at the end of 2004, GMAC Commercial Mortgage had gone through this whole entire reorganization and they ended up, dividing up parts of the business and part of the business was recapitalized. Our part of the business, our division of GMAC Commercial Mortgage was sold off to another organization called the Bankers Bank at the time that became known as Silverton Bank. It was a correspondent bank that effectively was owned at this point in time back in 2005, it was owned by, I believe, around 300 community banks. And it served as an entity that would go out and we would originate loans that we would turn around and syndicate, participate out to all these community banks. In some cases, some of these smaller regional banks as well would buy into these participations, which was huge, obviously, back before the great financial crisis. They also offered, other services like bank card services and back office services for these smaller community banks to allow them to initially scale up before bringing those operations in-house. And so I had worked at the Bankers Bank, which became known as Silverton Bank, running the hotel origination desk for several years before starting Peachtree. And that was really, from the assets or from the sale of our division at GMAC to Bankers Bank.
Interesting. And how did that experience at what point did you decide you wanted to leave the bank and go out on your own? How did that experience inform your starting of Peachtree?
Yeah, so it was, really going back to, I would say around 2004, 2005. And this is where I met, my partner, Matul, and, Jutton are, my two other partners in the business in Peachtree. I mean, I believe, Jutton Desai. You may or may not have met, Matul Patel, but Jutton and Matul were both really good friends before we started Peachtree. Three of us were good friends. And I had met both of them, at different times. I had met Matul in the late 90s, back when I first moved to Atlanta and first graduated from college. And we became, really good personal friends. But around 2004, 2005 time period, Matul and I would always talk about, wanting to go out and buy some hotels together or even develop hotels from the ground up. And so we were constantly looking at opportunity sets looking at potential opportunities to partner together. And finally, we found two assets to buy together in May of 2007. So I was still, working on the banking side at this point in time, but we found our first two assets to buy together. And that's when we started Peachtree. So I always say we picked the perfect time because we were at the peak before the great financial crisis. And from, May of 2007 till, first quarter of 2008, we went out and bought several more hotels. And we even, we ended up buying a bunch of land parcels to develop new hotels. And so we were very invested and really invested into the lodging and the hotel space before the great financial crisis. And so it, you know, fortunately it has worked out, and it actually worked out really well in those investments we made. But there was clearly a lot of challenges in 2009, 2010 we had to deal with.
Where were the first two assets that you bought?
Yeah, they were in Pell City, Alabama. So we made, you know, bought our first two assets, which Pell City is about 30 minutes outside of Birmingham, Alabama on Interstate 20 between Atlanta and Birmingham. So it's, you know, clearly closer to Birmingham, but those were the first two assets we bought. It was a Hampton Inn, Holiday Inn Express. And we actually ended up doing well in those assets. You know, we carried them through the great financial crisis and still delivered, you know, ultimately delivered like around a 170 equity multiple in our investments and around a 10% return when we sold those assets, you know, back around 2013, 2014 time period.
I would have to imagine though, 2007, 2008, then Lehman collapses, the GFC hits. You weren't feeling, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but how were you feeling? I can't imagine, you know, you were riding cloud nine at that moment, having just started your own business. Or did you see this as an opportunity and, you know, you knew you were going to get through it, you just needed to trudge along?
Yeah, so it's funny how everyone sees things differently, right? Like at that time period, like in 2007, obviously in the fourth quarter of 2007, you probably recall the CMBS market really pulled back. And it was the first signs that we were probably, the first warning signs at least were there that we're probably heading to something larger. And on the banking side at this point in time, our business was exploding because pretty much all the non-traditional lenders, all the institutional lenders were pulling out of the market. And, you know, regional banks, community banks were all benefiting. You know, the national banks started pulling back from a lending perspective. But our business, you know, at this point in time, at Silverton was exploding. So we were doing really well in the fourth quarter of 2007, as well as even in the first half of 2008. But it was around the first half of 2008, I realized, because you could start seeing in the data, you know, the performance of hotels were starting to pull back, you know, meaningfully. And we started seeing that pullback. And that's when I realized that, you know, because when we started Peachtree, it was really more of a personal investment vehicle for myself, Matul, Jutton. You know, we viewed it as more of a small family office. And we didn't view it as we're going to be this private equity shop, but we really thought it was going to be a vehicle for us to personally invest, along with like my family members and along with Matul and Jutton's family members. And then we quickly realized in 2008, you know, in the first half of 2008, that we're going to have to play defense across all these investments that we just made. And simultaneously, there's going to be a huge opportunity set that's going to come out of this in some format. We didn't know if it was going to be able to go out and buy, you know, debt per se. We didn't know if it was going to be able to buy assets on the cheap, but we figured there's going to be some opportunity set there. So that's when we really took a step back and said, okay, let's reevaluate the business. And we made the decision to internalize the operation side of the business, where we took back the, because you know, at this point in time, we were using third-party operators to run the hotels that we owned. You know, so we had about eight hotels in the mid part of 2008, and we took back the operations. And then we also, you know, set up our own development company to handle, you know, any of the projects that were under construction. And that's when we internalized both the development and operation side of our business. And then we quickly shifted. So those two businesses allowed us to play defense on our investments. And then we shifted from a standpoint of being able to go out and make new investments and be able to play offense. And we started focusing on going out and buying, you know, at the end of 2008. Really going in the first half of 2009, we shifted and started buying, you know, focusing on buying distressed debt. And we bought a bunch of distressed debt in 2010, 2011 from regional banks, community banks, you know, from the FDIC and so forth, where we bought a lot of discounted loans secured by hotel assets, by non-hotel commercial real estate assets like busted subdivisions, and really took advantage of that trade, back during the great financial crisis.
I think what you said is fascinating about bringing the asset management back in-house. We'll talk about, you know, some of the investing that you did during the downturn of the GFC, but what was it that sparked you to realize that you needed to bring the asset management and kind of everything in-house at a time when the external world seemed to be unraveling very quickly?
Yeah, it was just the it was basically just watching the performance really turn negative very quickly, you know, during the great financial crisis, because it was no different than during the pandemic. You know, the difference being during the pandemic, you went from record occupancy to zero occupancy overnight. During the great financial crisis, you just constantly started seeing performance decrease. And at this point in time, we were using third-party operators to run the hotels that we own. And the challenge there was these operators were under a lot of, you know, they were distracted because they had challenges across their whole entire portfolio of assets. And in a lot of cases, they owned their own assets as well. So their attention quickly flowed to their own assets, trying to save those assets. And we just didn't feel like we were getting the appropriate attention. And that's when we made the decision, you know, let's just internalize the operation. And we have, you know, because we had debt against all these hotel assets that we own. In many cases, we had personal recourse. So we knew we had to be able to play defense and wanted to be very proactive in managing and asset managing our investments. And the best way to do it is to control the operations. That's why we, you know, established our own property management company. We still even have it today, you know, although we've grown our platform substantially through the years. You know, we still have our own operation platform today to be able to effectively play defense, because you don't make a lot of money operating hotels. You know, you make most of your money, you know, on the investment side. You know, when you go to sell the assets, you know, from the cash flows on your investments and so forth.
And at this time, I think you mentioned it was set up originally as a family office. So did you have any outside investors, friends and family or otherwise, or was it really just your own, I guess, family you had? But did you have that fiduciary responsibility to other investors that you did not personally know?
No. So it was all really, you know, primarily just family members, or we had a couple of close friends that would invest with us, you know, back during this 2007, 8, 9, even in 2010 time period. So we were truly very close to being a, you know, what a lot of people, you know, qualify as a family office today. We were truly initially set up as that, where it was just, you know, our capital along with these family members. Now, from a fiduciary perspective, it's really hard to go to Thanksgiving dinners if you're not performing on your investments. And so it was much harder to actually to be a fiduciary to your parents and to your, like my grandfather and my grandmother, and have to deliver bad news. So we worked probably 20 times harder to make sure we delivered. Even today, you know, my family still, along with my partners, you know, our families all still invest in everything we sponsor.
Fascinating. So you started to talk a little bit about the broken deals that you saw, you know, and was it at that point that you started branching out of, you know, just hospitality? I think you mentioned a broken subdivision deal. You know, what did that chapter kind of call it 2008 through, you know, the balance of the GFC / you know, the exiting that period look like for Peachtree?
Sure. So, you know, Peachtree in its early stages was, there's no question, was very focused to, you know, investing in branded hotel properties that were limited and select service or extended stay hotels, you know, under the Marriott, Hilton, Intercontinental flags, Intercontinental Hotel Group flags or franchises. But we also in 2000, you know, 9, 10, and 11 started making these non-hotel investments where we were buying, you know, primarily we'd buy these larger pool of loans. And this is where the non-hotel exposure started coming, because banks, these regional banks and community banks, would be like, look, I'll sell you this hotel first mortgage loan, but I'm only going to sell it to you if you buy some of these other loans that are non-performing from us. And so they would, you know, force us to buy, in some cases, like a busted subdivision, you know, where it would be a bunch of empty lots that were, you know, planned for future, you know, housing developments. In other cases, it would be like maybe a small retail type strip center, or even, you know, we bought debt against, like, you know, some, you know, small office buildings and things like that during the great financial crisis as well. But the majority of what we did buy was hotel loans. But that's when we did start making our first non-hotel investments, was during the great financial crisis as a firm. But it was all on the credit side. And we actually delivered really good returns, actually even in some cases, even better returns than what we've received on the hotel side, buying these busted subdivisions and buying some of these non-hotel loans during the great financial crisis. So we did really well across all the investments we made during that time period.
And at what point did you transition to, you know, from the quote unquote family office to an investment management business? What did that look like?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So it was around, you know, 2010, You know, we obviously became very opportunistic, you know, took advantage of the great financial crisis, as we talked about in 2009, 2010. It was in 2012, we realized, okay, well, the ability to buy loans didn't exist anymore. And we were buying hotel assets and we were still developing hotel assets from the ground up in 2012 and even in 2011. But we saw, at this point in time, we saw that there was an opportunity set to go out and do direct lending. And so we shifted our, you know, debt buying business to doing direct lending to groups that needed first mortgage loans to go out and refinance or acquire new hotel assets as well as other commercial real estate assets. And so we started to realize in 2012, our business was more than just being a family office or even being, because a lot of times we'd go to conferences in 2012 and 2013 and people would be like, okay, well, they would view us as an owner of hotels. In some cases, they would say, well, you're an operator of hotels because we were operating, call it around 2013, probably around 20 assets or so. In other cases, people would say, well, you're a developer because I see you're developing, you know, hotels in different parts of the country. And our response would be, well, we do that. We're really not a developer or just an owner or just an operator or even just a lender. We're more than that. And that's in 2014, we went through this transition where we really reorganized the business and said, okay, what are we as an organization? And we were always finding inefficiencies in the marketplace to make new investments. So we're always finding, you know, where's the best use of capital to drive the best outsized returns or outcomes to the investments we're making. And we quickly realized that we're really a private equity shop. And that's when we made that transition into being, you know, if you want to call it an investment platform or a private equity shop, that's when we made the transition and said, okay, we're a vertically integrated private equity firm that's investing primarily into hotels, but we're making investments outside of hotels as well across commercial real estate. And we made that leap in 2014. And, you know, and when we say vertically integrated, obviously having the ability to operate, develop, lend, asset manage, all these different businesses that we've, you know, had back in 2014, as well as other businesses we've created since then, you know, as part of our vertical integration and really allows us to drive and optimize those investments that we're making across the platform.
I think that's a great segue. Let's talk about what is Petrie today. Give us the, like, you know, the headline numbers in terms of size and scale, and, you know, talk to us about the business lines that you're in. Give us an overview of what 2024 Petrie looks like.
Yeah. So, you know, Petrie's grown, as I mentioned, tremendously through the years. And as you look in 2024, you know, today we have over $2.5 billion of equity under management across about $5 billion of assets. You know, we're heavily invested, as we've talked about, across the hotel space, but we also have investments across pretty much all commercial real estate property types. As an organization, we own, you know, we have other investment strategies too outside of real estate. You know, for instance, we own a business that does a lot of film finance. So we're, you know, slowly becoming a bigger lender into the film space where we finance directors and producers to create new films where we're leveraging the different distribution rights that are being sold across the world. And that's how we're financing, you know, those producers to make those films. So we're doing other things, and that's just one example, but we're doing a lot of other things that are, you know, either within or even outside of commercial real estate beyond just, as we've talked about, doing, you know, just direct lending or owning and operating real estate. So we've continued to, you know, just grow across the platform. And as we sit here today, we've made over 700 investments since 2007. So we've always been very active on making new investments, and we've exited out of over half those investments. So we're still, you know, today we have over 300 investments that we're still servicing across the platform. And, you know, we currently operate about 90 hotels across the US, and we have well over 200, you know, first mortgage loans that we're servicing, as well as we own a business that does a lot of commercial property assessed clean energy loans or CPACE loans. You know, we're one of the largest originators in that space. And we have a huge book there, as well as, you know, as I mentioned, the film finance business and some other businesses.
Out of curiosity, you mentioned you see yourself as a private equity firm. You didn't say a real estate private equity firm. And then we talked about film finance. Is it, when we're thinking about kind of putting people into buckets, is it right to think that you see yourself more as a private equity firm that does real estate and other private equity type investments? Or how do you think about the positioning of Petrie given the breadth of your portfolio?
Yeah. So, I mean, hands down, majority of our assets under management are real estate, you know, driven if it's on the credit or equity side. But as a firm, the reason I don't see us as just a real estate private equity firm is the fact that as an organization at our core, we're looking for inefficiencies in the marketplace that we can take advantage of to drive outsized returns relative to the risk that we're taking. So it just happens to be real estate historically is what we're focused on, but we've made a lot of money, you know, making investments outside of real estate where we find some type of inefficiency. If it's like using the film finance, you know, example as one, where we find that, you know, inefficiency in the marketplace where we can drive really good returns relative to the risks that we're taking, we'll make investments, you know, into that space. And, you know, C-PACE lending is sort of, you know, I would say, although it's real estate, theoretically, it's real estate backed, you're really putting these property taxes on the assets, a little bit different. It's more of an asset-backed investment type strategy. So it's just an inefficient space where, you know, we're able to drive really good returns relative to the risk that we're taking across those assets when you look at, you know, how we're making those investments, how we're capitalizing those investments, and the risks we're taking to get, you know, the ultimate returns we're making.
So I want to come back to C-PACE and to hospitality. We could talk about film as well because I think it's fascinating. But 700 investments since 2007 is a tremendous volume. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, what does the team look like? How big is the company in terms of kind of the corporate staff? Obviously, you're going to have a lot more, you know, in your assets, I'm sure, at the hotel level. And then how are these deals traditionally capitalized? Are you raising money deal by deal, or do you have a fund series? Like, how does that work from an organizational perspective?
Sure. So, you know, from an organizational perspective, we have, you know, close to 300 corporate team members. So we have, you know, a pretty large corporate bench across the organization that are, you know, set up to go out and, you know, identify investment opportunities, to underwrite, asset manage, service, operate, development, and so forth. And then, you know, out in the field at the different hotels that we operate, we have, you know, an even larger team out there. You know, we've got, you know, called over 3,000 team members across the different hotels that we operate. So we have, you know, a large organization from that perspective. And it's, you know, so it's something that, you know, we're set up very well from that perspective. And then what was the other question?
So how do you capitalize your transactions? Do you do this in a fund series, or do you do it on a deal by deal basis, or a combination?
Yeah. So when we look at our investments or how we make our investments, the majority of the investments are made through a fund series. So usually, you know, we have a fund strategy where we're going to go find an investment strategy that we feel is very scalable, and we'll make those investments out of funds. And, you know, in many cases, what we've done is we'll go in and we'll really incubate an idea, meaning we'll go in and corporately, we'll make a lot of the initial investments, like when we did the C-PACE business, even this, you know, the film finance business, because those are two businesses that we've launched in recent years, and we'll incubate those businesses corporately. And once it gets to a scale where we feel like we can go raise a fund around that strategy and we feel like it's scalable enough, then we'll launch a fund that will, you know, focus on that strategy. So that's typically how we capitalize our investments. And then we have a lot of these, you know, that ends up happening across our fund vehicles. We end up having a lot of, you know, different co-investments that we end up doing in order to manage risk across individual investments. And so because we tend to be very, from a portfolio management perspective, we tend to try to, you know, control how much exposure we have to, you know, to any individual investment across these different funds. And so, you know, like in the last year and a half, we probably have done, you know, call it 15 to 20 different co-investments outside of our funds to help, you know, and these are investments that were made through our flagship funds, but to help manage risk and so forth.
So do you seed the funds? And when you say you start it from a corporate perspective, you're, you know, making loans, you're, you know, buying assets, whatever it may be. And then are those kind of seeded vehicles? Is that how it would typically work? So an investor can see the first few deals that might be in the fund?
In some cases, we have seeded some of the funds. In most cases, we have a pipeline that's very robust. And so, like, you know, for instance, we'll go from, you know, one credit fund to the next credit fund because we've done four different credit focus funds. And, you know, in each of those cases, as we go from one series to the next, you know, usually we'll have a pipeline of opportunities. And although they're not closed in that fund, you know, investors that are looking to invest will be able to see that opportunity set, and they're able to, you know, make, or at least they're able to have some visibility. And there's usually allocation policies between those vehicles and so forth.
Understood. And then, you know, last question on kind of capitalization. Are your investors traditionally institutional investors or non-institutional? You know, what does that look like?
Yeah, so we have a wide range of different groups and individuals that invest with us. So we do have high net worth, super high net worth, family offices, registered investment advisors, you know, endowments and pension funds that all allocate capital into the different vehicles that we sponsor.
All right. Well, let's talk a minute about a few of the different strategies before we get into the macro. So you mentioned CPACE. For our listeners who aren't familiar, you talked a little bit about how it's more of an asset-backed strategy. Can you describe kind of the 101 or 201 CPACE and kind of why is it so attractive as a strategy for you all?
Yeah. So I think it's great for developers, you know, owners of commercial real estate as well, because a lot of people are using retroactive CPACE to help recapitalize assets where someone just recently opened up projects today, as well as if you're developing a new project, it's a great source of capital as well. And then for us as a, you know, owner of the business that does CPACE loans, what happens is effectively we're going out and making investments that are, you know, call it 20 to 30%, in some cases a little bit higher, but 20 to 30% of the underlying total value of these assets that are typically new projects, although they can in some cases be renovation projects. But the majority of what we do across the CPACE business is we help capitalize and finance new construction projects. And in many cases, we can, you know, we can sort of mirror this project with, you know, we'll have our CPACE loan and then we can do a construction loan on top of it. And it's just a better execution for the borrower because the CPACE loans, especially in today's environment where interest rates have risen very quickly, in a lot of cases, you're able to get fixed rate debt that's around, you know, call it 8%, in some cases less, or some cases a little bit more on the CPACE side. And it's, you know, it's a pretty attractive rate just given market conditions today. So
in CPACE is the legislation, or PACE financing is a legislation around energy efficiency in new buildings, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's all about energy efficiency. Basically, it's for projects that are, you know, more energy efficient, which, you know, if you're building a new project today, it's very likely your project would qualify. And if you have a, you know, new project that opened up recently, you know, it's a great program as a source of liquidity, which, you know, a lot of banks will allow. And we've done a lot of these projects recently where a project's opened up recently, someone developed a new, maybe it's a multifamily project, a hotel project, it could be an industrial, you know, whatever the project is, but assume it's a $100 million project. Will come in and provide a $20 to $30 million loan because the existing bank may have a $70 million loan on the project. The borrower put in $30 million of equity. The project opened up and the bank, which may be a regional bank's looking to deleverage their exposure, the borrower may not have underwritten, you know, interest costs being as high as it is today. And so they're looking for, you know, some level of liquidity for interest reserves as they ramp up the property. So we can come in and in many cases, we'll provide like a $20 million loan that will pay down the existing senior loan and then provide some liquidity for interest reserves going forward. So like assuming we made a $20 million loan on this hypothetical $100 million project, we may pay down that $70 million senior loan, assuming they had 70% financing down to $55 million. And then we'd turn around and as part of that $20 million loan, we'll give them $5 million of like an interest reserve account to pay interest on the senior loan and to help, you know, cover interest costs on the CPACE loan and things like that as well.
Fascinating. And are you, I think you said you're one of the largest originators of CPACE. Is that, who else is in that market? I'm not looking for like firm names, but, you know, are these kind of non-bank financial institutions, lenders that are most active in the market?
Yeah, it's pretty much all non-bank lenders, mostly institutional groups, private equity shops like us are in and around this trade. I think there's a lot of interest from a standpoint of other private equity shops, other, you know, lenders trying to get into this business. There's several trying to get into it right now. It's just very challenging because, you know, we have the benefit. We were an early adopter to this program. We, you know, learned the business going back years ago, and we've really done a great job building out our, not only the network of, you know, potential borrowers and relationships with different, you know, brokers and borrowers and so forth. But we've also, we really understand how the program works in the different states because it does vary by states. And we have, you know, a team internally that does a great job going out and originating and underwriting and servicing. So we feel like we have, you know, a huge advantage to the marketplace given we've been focused on it, but also given the fact that we are, you know, we're diversified internally from the standpoint of doing all this lending on the construction side and doing acquisition loans. So we see all these different projects, have all these relationships with owners of real estate. We have relationships with banks, and we've helped banks help them deleverage without even taking losses on their books to, you know, sell off loans through CPACE lending as well. So it's been a great program for us. It's great for the counterparties that are involved. If it's a bank that's got the senior loan, it's great for the borrowers and sponsors to allow them to have capital to manage through all this volatility that's in the marketplace today.
Fascinating. Let's move to the hospitality side. You've been very active in the lending space for many years. What are you kind of currently focused on as it relates to hospitality in particular?
Yeah, so hospitality, you know, we're focused primarily on going out and developing hotels as well as acquiring hotels where there's a, you know, value add strategy. We do buy some stabilized hotels because we do have a DST strategy where we aggregate 1031 money into these DST structures in order to, you know, buy stabilized hotel assets. And under that strategy, we're just paying all cash through 1031 money. But outside of that program, primarily we buy, if we're buying hotel assets, we're buying assets that have more of a value add strategy where we're coming in and leveraging our operation platform. We're able to leverage our renovation team and construction team to go in and complete renovations to allow that property to be more competitive with its comp set. We're implementing brand changes in many cases that are accretive to the investment and so forth to create those values on the acquisition side. And then on the flip side, you know, development to us is super compelling today because there's not a lot of groups able to develop because it's very hard to get not only construction financing, but it's hard to raise the equity needed to do development because most lenders that are lending to development today are doing no more than 50 to 60% leverage. And so it's very hard for most developers to come up with 40 to 50% equity. And that's led to within the hotel space, as well as some of the other property types, because you're seeing the development pipelines start to drop off, especially as you go out over the next couple of years. And part of the reason, you know, the development pipeline within hotels have dropped off is because of that capital markets or the credit markets dislocation. But then also hotels during the pandemic, any new development project was put on the shelf because, you know, no one was traveling and there was concerns about the viability of the lodging business back in 2020. So those two factors have created the perfect storm for the hotel business in the sense that supply is growing at a, you know, call it a 30 to 40% reduction to historic averages. So supply is only growing at about 1% a year. Historically, supply grows at about 1.6% a year. And then demand, you know, there's just huge tailwinds to the growth of demand and travel. And demand's growing above 2% a year today, and it's expected to continue to grow over 2% a year for the next 5 years on average. And so demand's way outpacing supply. And there's a lot of just submarkets that lack hotels to support the demand in those markets. And the one thing that we've found within our business, within the hotel business, is that new always wins. And so if you can build new product today, you're going to, you know, when you open up, you should have strong, you know, underlying performance at the asset level. And then you also have, just from a standpoint of buyers, most of the, you know, public REITs, you know, if it's sovereign wealth funds, larger institutions, you know, larger private equity shops, they're all looking to buy new hotels. And those tend to trade extremely well when you're in a normalized environment. So we find developing hotels to be very interesting in this environment for those reasons.
I spend a lot of my time with institutional investors and allocators. And for whatever reason, hospitality, despite all of the phenomenal metrics that you just shared, tends to be a laggard or tends to be at the bottom of the list of things that people are interested in. I am seeing that change a little bit. But why do you think that is? Why do you think, you know, or maybe you don't see it that way. Maybe that's just my perspective. But I guess I could reframe the question to say, is this a institutional quality asset class? And if it is, how do you expect the asset class to continue to evolve given the current environment that we're in?
Yeah. I mean, hotels have always been challenged, right? And most larger institutions and a lot of the institutional investors, as you mentioned, are very wary to invest, you know, across lodging. And even smaller investors in many cases are wary to invest in lodging because you've had mixed results through the years. Because, you know, when times are good, all hotels do well when the market pulls back. That's where, you know, unfortunately, a lot of investors have lost a lot of money within the lodging space. I do think, you know, hotels, I would say this time around, when you look at what's happened with hotels, and there's a couple of different factors too. I think sometimes people end up saying hotels, you know, mean all hotels, but all hotels aren't equal in the sense that you've got like large full service hotels, you've got limited and select service and extended stay hotels that we primarily invest into. You know, you've got budget hotels. The hotel space is pretty vast of, you know, different property types. And there's no question the luxury hotels, the large full service hotels carry a ton of risk and they're always subject to economic conditions. The one thing we've found and the reason we stay invested across select service and extended stay and limited service hotels because they tend to have less volatility in that space. So I think it works better for institutional investors, that select service, limited service, extended stay space. And then the other factor I think that's just happened within, you know, lodging is, you know, and it makes it, you know, lodging today probably more interesting than what historically for institutions is, you know, you look at the cap rates that hotels trade at, like the cap rates for hotels are still pretty much at historic averages, right? Like hotels are trading at, call it 7 to 9% cap rates today for the type of hotels being the limited select, extended stay, premium branded hotels. And that's where they've traded for the last 15, 20 years in that range, depending on locations, you know, age of the asset and brand and so forth. Whereas you look at like multifamily, you know, during the pandemic, I mean, the cap rates there just compressed to this unsustainable level. And you've seen this recalibration in cap rates over the last 18 months where, you know, the cap rates within multifamily have started to expand out because the 10-year treasury rate has, you know, it's doubled from where it was over the last 12 years. And so I think, you know, I think most institutions are starting to look harder at hotels because they are starting to realize there's more reprice. Although, you know, multifamily, industrial, you know, make a lot of sense, there's just more repricing risk in those assets as those cap rates continue to normalize back out to historic levels. And hotels have less repricing risk, not to mention you have like a record amount of supply getting delivered in multifamily versus hotels is totally the opposite. So hotels have, you know, I would say probably more interest today from institutional groups wanting to learn more because they see that opportunity set. And then the final factor is just the under allocation of capital to hotel stake. You know, the dry powder on the sidelines that's been raised over the last several years, you know, only call it 4% of that capital is allocated to hotels. Yet hotels make up 7% of the commercial real estate ecosystem versus like multifamily today, you know, makes up 35% of the commercial real estate ecosystem, yet over 50% of the dry powder is allocated to multifamily. So to me, there's not as much opportunity, there's not as much inefficiency in that marketplace in multifamily to find opportunities versus hotels where there's an underallocation of capital relative to its size. And I think you can find more opportunities today within hospitality and you have less of the negative leverage issues if you're a lender. That's why you're starting to see more lenders look at the hotel space today as well, given the fact that hotels trade at higher cap rates and ultimately lead to higher debt yields versus some of these other property types.
That's fascinating. And the 4% statistic is fascinating. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, what percentage of select service hotels in North America or in the United States are institutionally owned? I would have to imagine it's a pretty small percentage. There's a lot of family businesses and non-institutional capital sources that kind of take up the long tail here. I'm guessing, but you probably know better than I do.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't have an exact percentage, but if I had a sort of guess off the cuff, I mean, I would say probably 30% of the limited select service hotels are owned by, you know, institutions, right? And the other 70% are, you know, owned by mom and pop type operators or regional groups. And so there's a lot of inefficiencies between those groups and how they operate. And that's, you know, that's a huge opportunity set, you know, to take advantage of as an investor.
If I'm an institutional investor, or if I'm an investor that's been neutral to bearish on hotels historically, but I'm interested in getting back into the space, what are the two or three questions that I should be asking either myself or groups like yours to better understand, like how to, you know, let's assume we're starting at 0 or 1 on a scale of 1 to 10. How do we kind of build up our knowledge? What are you hearing from smart investors who are really interested in digging into the space right now?
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's a tough question to answer because it just varies based on the actual strategy. But if you're new to the hotel space, I think it's more understanding what's the experience of that sponsor, how they've executed through cycles, and have they been successful managing through like a great financial crisis, a pandemic, you know, what's their track record and being able to manage through those, you know, cycles. What's, you know, why do they want to go buy, like their strategies on buying assets? Are they putting the right vehicles together? Because, you know, buying a stabilized hotel works well for like a public REIT. Does it work as well for a, you know, private equity, you know, shop or a private equity type fund? Probably not, because, you know, when you buy stabilized assets, there's not a lot of upside usually in those investments, and you're just, you know, buying cash flow. And that's why it works well for a DST strategy. It works well for a, you know, a public REIT and so forth, versus buying, you know, if you're going to go buy an asset with a value add strategy, is it well thought out from a branding perspective, what brands you're choosing? Or even if you're developing hotels, you know, understanding the different brands, because I see where I see people lose a lot of money in our space is they end up either investing in a project where someone's developing a hotel in a submarket, they're partnering with a hotel developer that has good intentions, but they just choose the wrong brand for that location or the wrong product type, because you're building a transient hotel in a market where you should be building extended stay hotels, or you're picking a brand that's gonna, that historically is underperformed, you know, for what it is, and you could have picked a better brand that's going to drive better performance. And so you just have to be thoughtful in that regard, or you're building an independent hotel. And I've seen this many times where someone wants to be the hometown hero and build, you know, the Taj Mahal. And it's more of, I call it an ROE play for them, where it's return on ego versus, I always tell everyone we're focused on IRR, whereas a lot of other groups are focused on ROE, that return on ego, and we're focused on actually driving cash flows and actual returns on the back end as well.
I'm personally fascinated in this space. I could talk to you for hours and ask you questions about every brand, but we don't have hours to do that. So I'll save that for another time. But one thing that is on my mind, you've been very public about commenting on the macro economy. Rates are going to be higher for longer, not just specific to hospitality. It's a two-part question. Curious to know your outlook on rates in general and what that means for private credit, a business that you're very active in. And it's not lost on me that, you know, you kind of started your career with Silverton at a similar point in time. So maybe there's some parallels that you can share. So I think that that's one, is like rates in private credit. And then I want to make sure that we hit on the health of the consumer. I've had conversations with you and Jutton in the past, and I think you have a really interesting perspective, given that you are in the select service hotel space, on what's happening from a consumer perspective. And I want to make sure we hear those. So you could take the questions in either order, but let's talk about both.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think hands down private credit, like we've talked a lot about the equity side of hotels and so forth. If you're going to invest in commercial real estate, investing in hotels, I mean, I think there's opportunity sets on the equity side, but it's more rifle shooting. There's not a macro trade in equity in hotels or in some of these other property types. I think hotels, there may be more of a macro trade just because of some of the things we talked about earlier with the underallocation of capital. But even then, I think the best opportunity is to invest through private credit right now, because you can go out and finance groups to acquire assets, to develop assets, to recapitalize assets, where you're financing 60 to 70% of the acquisition costs, you know, the values of these underlying assets. And you're getting returns that are very similar to what it would be if you were investing through the equity side. And that's really a function of just, you know, there's not as much debt capital in the marketplace from traditional sources like regional banks, community banks, and you're able to, you know, drive higher spreads, not to mention the index rates are much higher. And that's what's allowing for that opportunity set to exist today. So it's very compelling to be on the private credit side. And I think if you take just a step back, I mean, I think interest rates are going to be, like, I think interest rates obviously have risen dramatically over the last, you know, 20 months or so. But I think interest rates are going to stay higher. I think a lot of people expected rates to drop in the first half of this year. I think it's very, you know, my personal opinion is I'm not expecting rates to drop much more than maybe 2 times to 3 times this year. I would not be surprised if rates didn't even drop this year, just looking at the strength of the public markets. And that's helping, you know, the consumer stay healthy as well. And you know, the job market has continued to remain healthy, although you've seen some layoffs, but people are continuing to be employed. You know, people that want opportunities are able to find opportunities. Unlike during the GFC, we didn't have the, you know, the gig economy. it wasn't as prevalent as it is today with, you know, Uber, you know, being able to really find other ways to complement your income to support your lifestyle. We didn't have those opportunities back, you know, even during the GFC. So this is, you know, it's created just a totally different economy. It's created a consumer that's, you know, from my perspective, more resilient than what we've experienced. Not to mention, as I talked about the public markets, we haven't seen that pull back to a level to really pull down the ability for consumers to spend money. So maybe that changes later this year, and maybe that's the impetus to rates dropping substantially higher than I'm expecting. But even if rates drop, you know, ultimately, I don't expect the 10-year treasury rate to drop significantly from where we are today. I mean, the 10-year treasury rate, you know, over the last 12 years has averaged around 2%, around 2.2%, I believe. Today, we're at, you know, 4.3%, call it. And I think when you look over the next 5 years, I think we've basically entered an environment where the 10-year is probably going to average around 4%, maybe a little bit higher, maybe a little bit less, but it's not going to be at 2%. So we're going to be double. And if that's the case, I mean, I think there's just going to continue to be really challenging as the market's trying to recalibrate and absorb these higher rates on the equity trade side. It's going to be very hard to find, you know, really good opportunities to drive these great returns that we've seen that have existed over the last, you know, 12, 15 years through cap rate compression. The returns were driven through cap rate compression. When you're in an environment where cap rates are going to continue just to expand out as risk premium spreads continue to recalibrate to historic ranges, which hasn't happened across like multifamily, for instance, they're still compressed by a good probably 7,500 basis points from historic averages. So I think as you just look at the marketplace, it's just very challenging to invest in equity and commercial real estate. On the flip side, the debt side feels really good because you're in at a, you know, basis that I would argue is protected with, you know, downside protection, and you're getting return profiles that are very similar to the equity side.
So if there's a sponsor listening who has a project that needs financing, are there any asset classes that you're not active in right now, or are you looking across all of commercial real estate? What should people make sure that they're flagging to Peachtree?
You know, we're looking at everything. I mean, office is without question the toughest property type for us to finance. You know, we have done some office investments, not a lot on the office side, but you know, we will make loans on office on a selective basis. But I will tell you, just with all the secular distress in office, most of the stuff we've seen in office is just way too challenged. And that's why we haven't bought a lot of loans secured by office assets. That's why we haven't made a lot of direct loans in that space. But, you know, by far, we're making loans across, you know, pretty much all commercial real estate property types. We're very active within hotels, multifamily, industrial. We're doing a lot of horizontal, you know, land development across, you know, these different developers that are building out, you know, subdivisions and lots to sell off to the public home builders and builder rent groups. So we're active, you know, pretty much across most property types, and even including retail. We've been very active in financing groups that are acquiring malls as well as other retail parcels and so forth.
Fascinating. I just want to finish up on the consumer again. You touched on the resilience of the consumer and the strength of the public markets. And we're recording this, you know, at the end of February of 2024 for context. Yet, you know, we've heard the R word, the recession word, come up a bunch. We hear statistics about, you know, credit card debt. Yet the consumer is still spending like it's 1999. You know, I was out to dinner last night in a suburban part of San Diego at 8 o'clock, and the restaurant was packed. And I said, you know, who are these people? Who's eating out? You know, we were celebrating something special, but it seems like you see the same thing in your hotels, right? And we're seeing it across many parts of the economy. You know, what is it like? What's your viewpoint through the lens of your, you know, either your lending business or your hospitality business that's going on with the consumer right now that's driving travel and discretionary, or maybe in some cases in your world, non-discretionary spending? But like, how would you describe that situation to us?
Yeah, it's hard to figure out exactly what's happening. But I think, you know, from my perspective, I think there's just been a shift in mentality. Like consumers, you know, they're not necessarily, like given the higher interest rates, they're not selling homes, they're not moving as frequently as they were over the last, you know, decade. And now all of a sudden they've shifted and they really, coming out of the pandemic, they value the experiences. They value going out to restaurants and spending time with friends. They value being able to travel and going to see family members and go visit with customers and so forth, if it's corporate travel. And so I just think there's more money being allocated to the experience side of their balance sheets. And most consumers today are making more money than they were pre-pandemic. I mean, let's just face reality. Everyone's making more money. There's been inflation. We've been in an inflationary environment, and everyone likes to talk about inflation's coming down, and inflation is coming down, but we're not in a deflationary environment. We're in a disinflationary environment. So it means inflation is still growing. And so we still have positive inflation. And I think it's going to be really hard. Everyone has a different opinion on where inflation is going to settle. And again, if we end up, you know, settling below 2%, then we probably went through a hard landing to get there, is my gut take. I think, you know, the Fed's going to, you know, struggle to get it all the way down to 2% without having a pretty, you know, substantial economic recession. And it just, it doesn't feel like that's going to be the case based on what's happening in the public markets, nor what we're seeing just happening across the labor markets and so forth.
Yeah, well, I think only time will tell in this particular situation. Well, Greg, I think we're just about out of time today, but if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you or a member of the Peachtree team, learn more, figure out, you know, how you might be able to finance one of their projects, or, you know, interested in investing in one of your vehicles, what's the best way for people to learn more about Peachtree and get in contact?
Yeah, definitely feel free to reach out to myself or, you know, anyone on our team. Please visit our website, you know, at peachtreegroup.com. As well as, you know, you can email me or call me. I believe my contact information is on our website, but, you know, feel free to reach out, or you can reach out to Brandon, and Brandon can put you directly in touch with me. So that'd be great.
Easy. Well, Greg, thanks so much. As always, I've enjoyed the conversation. I appreciate you sharing your insights today.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend. And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter at B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.